and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
You're watching Consider This, the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Today, we celebrate Earth Day on a more somber note after a devastating year of a global COVID-19 pandemic. The theme this year is Restore Our Earth, which focuses on, among others, emerging green technologies and innovative thinking. But will we get the game-changing commitments and technological breakthroughs that will put us en route to restoring the planet's ecosystem? We'll discuss this tonight on the show. First up, we have Mina Rahman. Mina Rahman is the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia. Mina, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. If I may begin with news coming up from the US, where there is a virtual summit. US President Joe Biden is hosting 40 world leaders at this virtual summit to raise global commitment to tackle climate change. Now, I'm wondering, Mina, because the US, they themselves have pledged to cut carbon emissions by up to 52% below 2005 levels by the end of this decade. That sounds impressive, but is it as impressive as it sounds, Mina?
Well, actually, if you look at what the U.S. groups are saying, civil society groups in the U.S., they are saying that it doesn't go far enough when you look at it from what they call a fair-share perspective. This is something that we also in Sahabat Alam Malaysia and many groups also call for. Fair shares means you look at it from the perspective of the historical emissions and the cumulative emissions over the years. And what the U.S. groups actually have called for is 195% emission reductions based on 2005 levels. And what you see Biden promise is only 52% by 2005 level. So you can see a stark, wide gap between what the U.S. progressive groups are calling for and what President Biden has announced. And so for those of us who are not familiar, this is because there is a very limited carbon space left in the world. You have only like about 12 years of carbon space left before the temperature limit of 1.5 degrees is reached.
Mina, may I interrupt you there very quickly and get you to explain a little bit? A couple of questions here. Why is this benchmarked against 2005 emission levels? Why not 2021 levels? I mean, that was 16 years ago. Why are the emission levels benchmarked there, if you could explain to the audience? And secondly, what you mean in terms of a carbon space? Is it carbon...
Carbon
space. Yes, yeah. That's right. If you can explain a little bit.
Yes. Well, actually, 2005 levels are rather late, actually, because the benchmark auto has been 1990 levels. If you look at the parties to the Kyoto Protocol, for developed countries, the benchmark is supposed to be 1990. This was when the convention came into the climate change convention, the international convention that governs, agreement between the north and the south of the world. But they are looking at it from 2005 levels, because 2005 levels, the emissions are high. So if you're taking a 52% reduction, you're actually not going very much. Whereas if you look at 1990 levels, then you have to take a much deeper cut. Mm-hmm. So there is actually a lot of mumbo-jumbo in the numbers. And I think the devil is really in the details, and sometimes we all get confused. On the issue of the carbon space and the carbon budget, now everybody in Paris agreed that for the temperature rise to be limited to 2 degrees compared to pre-industrial levels, this is before the Industrial Revolution, or to pursue 1.5 degree limit. Actually, for those of us in civil society, we say that 1.5 limit is the guardrail. Mm-hmm. Now we are already at 1.2 degrees limit rise. So there is very little atmospheric space. You know, all these emissions are emitted into the atmosphere. The atmosphere, when the Industrial Revolution began, was, you know, there was no constraining. Everybody, actually the developed world, pumped as much possible in the carbon dioxide and carbon emissions into the atmosphere with no regard. Now, global warming came into discourse in the 1980s. So it was only then that was realized that the carbon emissions were going to cause a massive problem. So that's when people began to pay attention. So the rich world got rich by the massive pollution. And today, they are telling the whole world, and it is, of course, correct, that all of us have to constrain our emissions. But this is why the Paris Agreement has said that there is a common but differentiated responsibility, that you can't put the developed and the developing country on the same platform. Those who are rich, those who have polluted, and those who have become, industrialized countries, they have the greatest responsibility and a greater responsibility to cut the emissions far more dramatically than the developing world. That's why we cannot have this on the same platform.
Mina, so if I can interject. Yes. The question, I guess, when you look at the kind of demands made by progressive groups, as you call them, what impact would that make on the economy? And is, say, for instance, the American economy well-resourced or prepared for the economic impact of such a reduction in emissions?
Well, I think, Sharad, the point here is that the U.S. actually is a very unequal society. In fact, in terms of emissions around, the richest are the ones who are consuming and polluting most of all in terms of their lifestyle consumption. So you can afford to cut down on your consumption. You can't be going around, consuming as if the world is of no limit. And I think this is where we need to start. It is a transformation. It should have happened in 1990. You remember 1992, the Rio Summit. Already then, everybody knew that the planet cannot continue in terms of the consumption patterns and the production systems. That transformation ought to have happened already then. But we are delaying action. And the lifestyle of the Americans, as George Bush Sr. said then, was not up for negotiation. Now, that cannot be. You have to negotiate. So there is a stark contrast between the rich of the U.S. and the poor of the U.S., same in other parts of the world. In fact, the 10% of the richest people in the world are consuming 50% of, are responsible for 50% of the emissions.
Okay.
And the 50% of the world's poor are only responsible for 10%. So you see this stark inequity, and that has to change, both in the global north and global south, and also in the at the national level in terms of the inequities of who is really responsible
right.
for the problem.
Mina, just to build on that point, and I wanted to reference an article that you recently wrote about net zero pledges made by rich countries for 2050. And you argue that, again, as you said, it's not going to be enough. But I wanted to ask you about something you said about rather than net zero pledges, it should be real zero emissions. And then you also talked a little bit about, if I'm not mistaken, you talked about carbon colonialism and how, again, referring to what you've just mentioned. Could you briefly explain what you mean by real zero emissions?
Yeah. So when I talk about the carbon space, we're talking about what we have is 480 gigatons of space left. And we are emitting world over 42 gigatons every year. So in 12 years, we would have exhausted that at current emission levels. So we need to bring this rapidly down. Now, the rich world cannot continue to emit. In fact, if you look at the net zero pledges, net zero basically means if I emit one ton of carbon in the atmosphere, I will plant one tree and expect that tree to suck that carbon, so I become zero. So plus one, minus one, I attain zero. But this is actually a fallacy, because you cannot have net zero by 2020 for all countries. The rich world cannot do this, because the atmospheric space that is left cannot tolerate that anymore. So actually, they should have gone zero by now. In fact, the U.S. groups are talking about 195% reduction. This is like negative emissions. So you actually have to bring down emissions even below 100. So real zero actually means no excuse to do net anymore. You have to bring the dramatic, you have to decarbonize. Now you have to go to zero dramatically, And then you will also have to increase your things, of course. But what the developed countries are trying to do is they expect us in the developing world to do all this, keeping our forests and our grasslands and our wetlands and planting more trees so that we can suck up all that that emissions that they are going to put into the atmosphere. Now, if you count the net zero pledges and the amount of carbon sinks we need to create, you need another few planets. And we don't have that kind of
language. Mina, I understand that the U.S. government is also planning to reconvene that Obama-era major economies forum on energy and climate that focuses on really those countries, those rich countries that contribute the bulk of emissions. Do you welcome that? Do you see that as just a gesture, something symbolic, rather than having perhaps a material and practical effect on the situation with regard to climate change?
Well, actually, they call it the Major Economies Forum, but they initially began, they called it the Major Emitters. And it's not just the rich countries. They're including China and India in that calculus, actually. And if you look at the Chinese emissions and look at the Indian emissions, it is large. It's because of their population levels. So if you take a per capita time, the U.S. is much higher. The U.S. per capita is a few times higher than that of China and that of India. India is really much lower. So they are trying to bring all what they call the major emitters together to on a platform to do technology, to talk about how to do the dramatic emissions. But I do think that at the end of the day, if you really talk about the common but differentiated responsibility, they have to provide the financial resources. And this is what we've been calling. If you want the developing countries to go the low carbon pathway, particularly now that we are just recovering from our COVID experience, a lot of our economies are struggling. And if you look at the kind of money that many of the developing countries need to put on the table to actually sustain their health system, right, it's staggering. They can't even keep their hospitals together.
Let alone
money for science, for what we call it, climate change. So
Mina,
we need the financial transfer, we need the technology transfer.
So we understand that this virtual summit in the US is not part of the UN global process for climate change, right? That's likely to happen in November for COP26. Can you tell us what to expect? Is there going to be the same sense of urgency to hold large emitters accountable?
Well, at the moment, the big question is whether there will be a face-to-face negotiations or a virtual negotiation. That itself is a very big problem for developing countries, because if it's a virtual negotiation, many of our developing countries are suffering from the digital divide. They don't have access to the same kind of internet connection. So you can't even negotiate properly in a virtual setting. So COP26 is important, but it's not as if the countries only gather in Glasgow to make their ambitious pledges. They are supposed to make their ambitious pledges even now. So there's no excuse for the rich countries to actually do much better on their ambition. But we are very, it's quite disappointing to see the kind of announcements coming on because of this whole fanciful net zero and the carbon offset they're talking about and the carbon markets that they are talking about. So you go back to the same old conventional delaying tactic of climate inaction. Mm. And so we're really worried that that this net zero is not going to save the world. It's going to take us to actually a wrong direction of a further catastrophe. So we have to unpack the numbers, and we have to see the details for what they are. Right. But the rich world has no excuse, and they cannot continue to pursue.
Mina, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. We really, really appreciate your time. Thank you. We're going to take a quick break, but after this, we will come back and take a look at a local perspective. What is Malaysia's commitment to the fight against climate change? Stay tuned.